The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This is the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
Thanks for joining me again. In this episode, we explore the journey of bringing a play to life from both the theatre's and the playwright's perspective. Joining me today are Sharon Willems, the artistic director of Barons Court Theatre, and Christopher Lieberman, the writer-performer behind the play Bunny Man, which enjoyed a one-week run at Barons Court earlier this year. Sharon talks about what makes Barons Court Theatre a unique venue for emerging playwrights and the type of work they programme there, and her passion for supporting artists is catching. Meanwhile, Christopher takes us through his personal experience of self-producing Bunny Man, charting the challenges and triumphs of his journey to stage. I found Christopher to be wise beyond his years, and his drive to realise such a brave and authentic piece of writing without fear is both inspiring and encouraging. So if you're a playwright considering bringing your own work to the stage, stay tuned for invaluable insights, strategies and top tips from Sharon and Christopher. Plus, discover more about the Sunday Fix at Barons Court Theatre, a monthly scratch night providing a platform for new writing to be performed and discussed in a supportive setting. And just for transparency, my conversations with Sharon and Christopher were recorded separately on two separate calls. This episode has been cut together to focus on the central topic of bringing new writing to Barons Court Theatre.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast with Paul Kalbergi.
All right, let's dive in. Known for its eclectic mix of new writing and reimagined classics, Barons Court Theatre is a 52-seat studio theatre nestled in the basement of the Curtains Up pub, a cornerstone of the West London art scene since 1991. Under the artistic leadership of Sharon Willems since 2021, it continues to provide a supportive launchpad and a home for innovative theatre and theatre makers. Sharon studied dramaturgy at the prestigious theatre school at DePaul University in Chicago and brings a wealth of international experience to her role, having lived and worked in the USA, the Caribbean, Japan and Australia before arriving in the UK. Serving alongside executive director Leo Bachica, Sharon has invigorated the theatre with a fresh vision, expanding its programming to welcome diverse voices and fostering a strong sense of community engagement. The dedicated duo's efforts were recognised in the 2023 Offies, where Barons Court Theatre took away the People's Vote Award for Most Welcoming Venue. Christopher Lieberman is a writer, actor, and comedian from South London. As a playwright, he's brought his work to theatre companies across London, Cambridge, and Oxford. He also performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 2022 and continues to perform his sci-fi inspired work at comedy and cabaret clubs. Christopher's one-man show Bunny Man debuted at Barons Court Theatre in March 2024, showcasing his unique blend of storytelling, humour, and performance artistry. And the show is set to enjoy a second London outing in July as part of Bite Size Festival at Riverside Studios.
Coming up.
You don't have to have had like five shows and won an offie to like get into the Barons Court. You know, you just have to have a good story and be willing to do some work.
It didn't occur to me I would need anyone's help. I just kept doing the jobs a producer would do. And at some point I was like, I guess I'm producing this.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast.
Sharon, thanks for joining me for a chat.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Christopher, thanks for being here.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
So, Sharon, for anyone not familiar with Barons Court Theatre, could you give us a little introduction to your unique venue and tell us whereabouts you are in the capital?
Sure. We are in West London, so in between Barons Court Station and West Kent Station. We are one of the rare, I think one of the only spaces that's actually below a pub instead of being above a pub. That has its own special challenges and joys. And we are a 52-seater, so we're quite intimate. We're on three sides. So when you come to one of our shows, you're not far away at all. You're right in the action. So that makes it really special.
Interesting to be the only venue below a pub.
Yeah.
What would you say sets you guys apart in terms of the work that you program?
Well, I think a lot of the London pub fringe scene is doing the best it can to open doors for early career makers. I don't think we are unique in that, but I do think we are really emphasizing that. So a lot of the work that we do is either from an international artist that is trying to find their way in the diverse UK scene, perhaps someone that left theater and is coming back to it after looking after folks, elderly parents or children, or really just starting out. So we have a lot of folks that it's one of their first shows, their debut production, or their first show with their company. So for us, we really feel like a platform space, a space someone can come and try out an idea that perhaps in a larger scale might be too daunting. They might feel like they have to succeed. You can fail a bit more in a smaller space. And also be, I guess, a bit bold with the architecture we have. We've got these two pillars, which can either be seen as an obstacle or a design joy. You don't have to worry about building any kind of architecture there. So we're quite intimate. It suits to all sorts of storytelling. We've been on spaceships this year. We've been on the coast of Cornwall. We've been on in the fells of Cumbria. So we can still be quite expansive and epic, but certainly the intimacy of having the audience right near you means that if you are trying out an idea, you're going to get immediate feedback. So that certainly is helpful for folks, I think.
I think that's one of the really brilliant things about spaces. And as a writer, if you know where you're taking a play and you can really lean into that, because Baron's Court has that wonderful, almost dungeon-esque kind of feel that you could really, I mean, you could use that any way you want. Yeah. It's almost a ready-made set because it's so much character down there.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think design is something that more and more as I'm there, I'm hoping we'll have more designers come through. But certainly on the fringe, it can be one of those things that folks don't really have the funds to source or do as much as they want to with. So in some ways, it's really important to pick a space that suits the story you're telling. And with us, we're really lucky that if you want something that feels claustrophobic, if you want something that feels like, you know, another time, it's really great for period pieces, both forward in time and back in time, because you can quite easily kind of immersed in that space. So yeah. Certainly it's a consideration is the architecture. But I think that's true with any play. You've got to find the right home for it, really. Mm. It's not always about really going to, I think, for the name of the place as much as if it's the right circumstance and the right location. Because even the biggest spaces have an echo and a weird spot. Yeah. Or a sight line issue. So it's just about the right home for your story, really.
Yeah. Yeah. So what type of work has found a home at Baron's Court recently, and what have those runs looked like?
I mean, we do a lot of 1 week runs, 2 week runs. I'm just about to embark on a 3 week run. I think it's the first one this year we've had. And we're hoping to have a few more later in the year. But certainly we do have shows that just have 1 week to kind of start the play out, basically. Mm. In our winter season, we do, as I said, like a lot of new writing. So there have been a few co-productions that our in-house company has been supporting. So we've had a few shows that have taken a long time to gestate. But I know one that you mentioned might be familiar to folks is Bunny Man by Christopher Lieberman was just with us. And what was great about that is that he was part of a youth company that was in residence with us last year.
Oh, okay.
And so he was kind of aging out of that company and he'd already started writing the piece. And so we'd had a few conversations as they were doing showcases and things through the year. And he knew the space quite well because of that. So he knew that it was the right home for him. And what's great about his show is that it's a one person show. So you're very much with him the whole time. I think he did a really lovely imaginative story piece with the puppetry, with the ideas being quite big, but the story being quite personal. Yeah. So it was a lovely play. So I think recently we've been really lucky. I've been so proud of the work that's been coming through because we've been running it now for about 2.5 years to give artists a bit more time now to have a lead in so they can build an audience. They can feel like they've accomplished what they want to do with the piece and also move it forward and hopefully go to a larger space if that's their aim, or come back for a longer run if that feels, you know, more of what they're interested in. So yeah, we've done a lot of queer work, a lot of new writing, a number of debuts, as well as some revivals here and there. Yeah.
Christopher, maybe if we could start with a little introduction to yourself and if you could tell us a bit about Bunny Man.
Yeah, so I am 21 years old. I live in London. I've been writing my whole life and performing since I was about 17. I'm openly gay and transgender, and so I tend to write things about being gay and transgender. And I take a lot of inspiration from like sci-fi and horror. And so Bunny Man is my debut one-man show, and it was a horror comedy about a trans man navigating gay hookup culture, which I self-produced for a run at Barons Court Theatre in West London at the start of March.
Wow, gosh, everything you've just shared speaks of immense bravery and courage, not only in sharing such a personal story with audiences, but to do so at 21 is endlessly encouraging. Can we just back up a little bit and talk about the genesis of the idea and how the production that you eventually brought to Barons Court came to be?
So it's tricky because it's not really a linear story, but nearly 2 years ago, basically, I started hormone replacement therapy. So I started taking testosterone as part of my transition. And I was speaking to a friend of mine who he was like my mentor, and he is a theatre director and facilitator and dramaturg. And he said, "Oh, make sure you're writing this down because you're going to need this for your one man show one day." And I was like, "Okay, sure, whatever you say." But I took him at his word, and I kept very detailed scrapbooks and diary entries for the first few months of my transition. And then sort of at the end of that first summer, I did a scratch night at a pub theatre in London called the Bread and Roses. And it was fantastic. We had two nights and sold out both nights. I think it was me and maybe like 7 or 8 other creative groups bringing like short 10 or 15 minute mini plays. And mine was a monologue about myself having started testosterone, while at the same time being in a relationship with someone who had been bitten by a zombie. And so my body was changing on testosterone and his body was changing into a zombie. And so there was like the euphoria, dysphoria kind of thing there. And I loved writing it. I got really good feedback from it. And I sort of realized this is something that people might be interested in. It's something I'm capable of writing. And yeah, and then to be honest, I sort of parked it for a little while because I had to do other stuff. And I did a different show at Barons Court Theatre, right? And so I knew the space, and I had in my mind, I'd really love to do a show there because it's such a unique, you know, as pub theatres go, it's got a lot of character and I really liked it. And so I had these things in the back of my mind. And then about a year ago, spring 2023, I was pretty much ready to start writing my show. I just didn't know what it was going to be. And I watched Simon Amstel's Netflix special, Set Free. He has a lot of stories about like going to the rainforest and taking drugs and having these revelations about his life. And I think this is amazing how he's combined like the mysticism and the comedy and all this stuff. And they were just great stories. And so I kind of thought, I want to write a story about someone who goes into the wilderness and has some kind of revelatory experience. Yeah. And then I went on a camping trip with my friends. We went climbing in Fontainebleau, which is a forest in France, and we were camping. And while I was on this camping trip, I had two epiphanies. One of them was that I didn't want to stay at my office job and I wasn't finding it exciting. And the only thing I really loved was live performance. So I needed to quit my job and I needed to make it work, whatever I was going to do. That was epiphany number one.
Yep. Yeah.
And then epiphany number two is a bit weirder, but it's important to the story. I was texting with a guy who we were flirting, right? And he was like, "Oh, by the way, just before we carry on with anything, I just want to check, what words do you want me to use to refer to these parts of your body?" And I was like, "Oh, well, that's nice. No one's ever asked me that before." And then I was like, "Oh, no one's ever asked me that before." And so I like came away from that conversation being like, I didn't realize that I didn't know what it felt like to be respected by prospective sexual partners. And so I had that in my head. I had the camping in my head. I had all of these things. And as I say, I already knew what I really wanted to do in life was live performance. So I did some Googling. I was like, scratch nights in London, just determined to get on stage and do something. Mm-hmm. Booked myself in for a scratch night basically the next month. And then I was like, oh, okay, well, now I need to write something. And that's when I did the first draft of Bunny Man. It was only 15 minutes long, but it was, yeah, trans guy on a camping trip meets a woodland cryptid who makes him think differently about sex and makes him think differently about his body and all this stuff. And then someone who came to see that scratch night was like, this needs to be an hour long show. If you write more drafts, I'll read them and give you feedback and hold you accountable, which is exactly what he did. And so I kept redrafting, and then I sent it to Barons Court Theatre, and they were like, great, we have availability in March. And then that's the whole story.
Wow. Oh my gosh, it just, that must have been such a cathartic process for you at the end of it, to have kind of charted your journey and created something beautiful out of it.
I mean, I think so, but it's tricky to explain this to people, especially people who saw the show, because it's not a true story, and quite a lot of it is completely made up. So it's not a true story, but it's a very personal story.
Was your first thought, I need to self-produce this, by any means get this on stage? Or did you at that point go down the submission route and try to reach out and send it to artistic directors or literary officers?
No, I didn't do that. I think maybe it was, I was naive. It didn't occur to me I would need anyone's help.
I love that.
But equally, I didn't think I'm going to self-produce. I didn't set out to be a producer. I just had, you know, it had to happen. Someone had to do it. I just kept doing the jobs a producer would do. And at some point I was like, I guess I'm producing this.
Yeah.
It's also a case of, I knew I would never have any money and that the budget would always have to be zero or as close to zero as possible. And so I couldn't bring in other people aside from like my friends who are willing to read the script for free and give me notes because they're my friends. And later I had a co-director and we did profit share. And once I'd got like a full length draft, I already knew I wanted to go to Barons Court Theatre, and I knew that in order to approach them, they would want to read a draft of the script. So I was almost aiming for a draft to be a full length for the purpose of having to send it off. There's a theatre company based in South London called Boundless. They had a scheme over summer for young theatre makers. They were giving like free space to do whatever. And I wrote to them and said, I'd love to do a rehearsed reading of my show. And so I had a date in the calendar for a rehearsed reading as well, which was another fence post, I guess.
Yeah, definitely a great opportunity to road test the material, both at scratch nights earlier and then refine it further for the reading with Boundless. Sharon, could we talk a little about the considerations for playwrights who might be thinking about bringing a work to the fringe? What would you advise in terms of the readiness of a play before reaching out to you and considering, say, a one-week run like Christopher did at Barons Court?
Sure. I think the process is different. You know, for every script has its own midwifery process. Mm. I think we have helped folks in all different stages. At the moment, we've got a show coming up that was in our scratch night, a debut writer, first thing he's ever written, and then went away elsewhere and had some development, has come back. Or we've also had folks who've done readings with us. So they'll submit a script and we give a few notes or a few thoughts and say, look, you know, what do we need to get it ready? We discuss that as a kind of team in a way, and then they do some readings with us.
Yep.
And then I think the kind of cold submission process, if someone's felt like their script is really ready, then we'll sit and talk with them less about, I guess, the script, more the nuts and bolts of how to get along, who the audience might be, why they want to make the work, why we're the best place for it. And through that, we can also give notes about the script because we know that it's going to be with us and we can help them, you know, how to stage it so that it's the most effective. And then at the end of the week, we also chat with folks and say, you know, what's next for it? Do you want to do it again? Do you want to and never do it again? And what is it that, you know, we can do to help you kind of with what's next? And I think that the time that they're with us, we know what their goals are. As long as we have those clear conversations, we really want to help them get to that next stage. It doesn't have to necessarily be even about the next production. It's about what's next for them as an artist as well.
So Christopher, having realized the play as a full-length draft now, ahead of your one-week run at Barons Court, what were you thinking at that point were going to be the main takeaways? What were the goals that you'd kind of set for yourself?
It's tricky because right up until a few weeks before the run, what I'd been saying, and this is kind of still true, is that this Barons Court Theatre run is an end in itself. This is the goal, right? It doesn't have to lead to anything else. I want to enjoy the week I want my friends to come and see it. And doing the show is the whole thing. That's the goal, is to do the show. But then people kept asking me, oh, so what's next? What are you hoping to get? Like, and I was like, am I supposed to be hoping for something? Like, I mean, good reviews, I'm hoping for that. I don't even know really, because a good review is only a marketing tool. And so a good review is only worth anything if I use it to get something else. It's nice to be able to say that I've done it, but truly, like, the best parts of doing it were things that happened in the moment and can't really be quantified or reproduced in any way. I had really, really great moments between myself and the audience and having my friends come see it and all of that. And so will there be a payoff, or what will that look like? I don't know. And maybe there will be, and it might be months from now, but the whole joy of live performance is what happens in the moment. And I kind of stand by that.
Yeah, so absolutely. I think the real payoff is just in the doing, isn't it? Like you say, not every piece needs to make it to the National Theatre or the Royal Court or have a life beyond.
Yeah.
You know, realizing a new piece of work as a full-length play at Baron's Court Theatre is a monumental achievement and an accolade for you to take forward in itself. Like you say, the magic that you created on stage, that connection with the audience, that's the true magic of theatre.
Yeah. And I mean, okay, so I have a friend who likes to say, everything you do leads to something else. It's like, yeah, that's true. And it's good to think that work you put into something now is going to have knock-on effects to things that happen later. And that's great. It's a good way to not feel discouraged when you're working really hard and it doesn't feel like anything's happening. But I do think, as a rule for life, especially as creative people, the more things that you can treat as ends in themselves instead of a means to some other ends, the happier you will be. So yeah, I don't know. I'm not very utilitarian. Perhaps it's like lack of ambition.
not at all. And also, let's not underestimate the learning journey that you went on in terms of bringing that piece to Baron's Court. I mean, you can't put a price on that. So I think there are so many lessons that even you probably won't even be aware of until you need to apply them to something else that you've learned.
Exactly. This is going to be something I look back on in like 10 years time, do you know what I mean? So yeah.
How many 21 year olds have produced a show on the Fringe?
Well,
you know,
not many, but
it's really cool. You should be really proud.
Thank you.
So in terms of timelines and forward planning, Sharon, how far ahead are you currently programming at Baron's Court, and how far in advance do folks generally reach out to you when looking to secure dates?
Well, for us, I mean, we're in a very fortunate position at the moment where we're fairly booked through most of the year. We have things penciled for the autumn, maybe not as, you know, firm yet. So for us, we say, well, unless those things shift, it will be next year anyways for a longer run, certainly. I think we've got a little bit of time this summer here and there and a few weeks dotted around. But we're trying to slow people down as well in terms of feeling that urgency, that fear of not being seen, of needing to get stuff out before it's ready. I always suggest folks at least 6 months, because you want to be able to have a sound marketing plan and to really feel like you can execute it, you know, and delegate things out to hopefully the team that you've gotten together in those 6 months, you know, a month before it happens.
Because you
want to be able to focus on enjoying it as well. Because none of us make enough money, so we want to enjoy the process of making something. So we try, you know, get that timeline a bit stretched out for folks so they could do that.
What did your timeline look like, Christopher? How long did you have to make everything happen?
Oh, ages. Well, ages and not ages. So I approached them in August, but it was confirmed by September, and then the run was in March. So 6 months from when I signed the contract, basically, which was loads of time. These venues do tend to book quite far in advance. And I was like, I remember, like, in September, Leo said, well, it's a queer show, why not do it at Pride? And I was like, I'm not waiting any longer than I have to. I would do this in March. If it's the first slot you have, I want it. It literally couldn't come soon enough for me. But listen, tasks expand to fill the time you give to them. If I'd have had 3 months, I would have made it work. But yeah.
I asked Sharon about some of the strategies that have been most effective in marketing shows at Baron's Court, and Christopher how he reached audiences ahead of Bunnyman opening there back in March. It was interesting to hear from each of them how important human connection was in finding an audience and community versus putting all your efforts into online marketing and solely relying on social media.
I think marketing is about knowing why you're making the work and who you want to speak to. Like, I know it sounds really simplistic, but I think we get so wrapped up in the story we're trying to tell, we often forget who that other party is that's listening. And I think if the ones that have been really successful have really known, like, no, this is for this person. And how am I going to get my information to them? How am I going to get them from watching Netflix that night, come and see my show? Unless they know me, that's a clear draw. Or they know the space, that might be the draw. But how can I get my story out to folks? And I think giving yourself the time to think about your work in a way that isn't just about that fear that we all have about it not being good enough. Mm. I think if you can switch that off and give yourself time and go, imagine my work was good enough.
Yeah.
Who would want to see it? And then really laying out that plan. And then it's hard graft. It's a lot of emails. It's a lot of flyering. It's a lot of that kind of nuts and bolts work. And then just putting everything into your show and having people sell it for you then, because they'll come and see it and go, oh my God, this is so good.
Right.
And they'll tell their friends, and that word of mouth is that gold dust that you can't really count on, but you hope that you generate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what we really do is try to message each of the shows fairly across our channels. We're going to do, you know, some videos, some reels and stuff on Instagram and all the socials. So they know that they're going to have some support from us. I hope that that means it's less intimidating. They don't think they have to do everything on their own. But the marketing is still kind of held primarily with the artist, because it's their show ultimately. They know the best route, you know, to get to people. And if they haven't identified that, we try and steer them gently towards what we think are best practices. Yeah.
Is flyering still effective, do you think, today? Or would you advise people to kind of think about putting money into targeted ads on social media?
I do think social media is useful, but we have a certain number of local events where flyers are great to hand out. Mm. It's actually often like the most unexpected places, like the local paper, putting stuff there, putting up posters around the neighborhood. Like, that has actually been more useful than even social media often, because it's, I think the expectation is that social media is going to translate into dollars or pounds rather, but often it translates into people almost coming to see your show or wishing they'd seen your show versus actually showing up, unless they know you personally. I think people do hear it for the first time. And if they're new artists, then yes, maybe they'll come. But I think with so much choice in London, it's kind of, I think it's really hard to just count on social media. Mm. You know, you can just tell people, you can just be upstairs in the bar, you know, 15 minutes before the house opens and flyering. And that works as well. You can be at the tube station flyering, you know, or find out another way. So I think it's finding a mixed route. And sometimes things that work the best surprise you, getting on a certain mailing list that you've managed to get on because you've chatted with a charity, for example. Often that can reap the best rewards as well. So it's thinking kind of multiple levels. But once you know, if your audience is 18-year-olds, queer folks, and even within that, you need to drill down and say, well, this person is really interested in this, or, you know. So I think the more that you can be really specific, the more it helps. And then it's just keep going, just keep, even when you're exhausted and when you're sick of it, that's usually when you're just about done enough.
Do you know what's absolutely bonkers is I quit a 9-to-5 job in marketing to pursue theatre full time. And then I just spent all my time marketing for my theatre show. So mostly we did, well, social media, which is free. So that's good. But it doesn't have to be free. You can pay Facebook to promote, or Meta to promote your posts, or you can do targeted ads. I didn't do any of that though, because it costs money. We printed flyers and posters, and the posters went up at the theatre because it's under a pub and there's space around the pub for posters. And then they kept some of the flyers and I kept a lot of flyers. And what I did for like 2 months was I did some open mics, did comedy at open mics and at a cabaret. And I made like a 5-minute set out of the opening of the show.
Brilliant.
And did that. And then I was like, if you like that, I thought that was funny, come to the show.
Yeah.
Handed out flyers.
That's great.
I have friends who do cabaret, and so a couple of them were like, come to my show, get up on stage just before the interval, plug your show and hand out flyers. Very grateful for that. There's a queer like art market that happens every few months. I emailed them and was like, do you mind if I flyer at your market? Yeah, and then I dropped off flyers at like queer bookshops and sex shops in Soho. They were very useful, I will say. They were very receptive. And yeah, so the flyering and social media were basically the bulk of the marketing.
So it sounds like you did put in a lot of legwork as well to get out and do that.
It never ended.
I love that you were able to lean into the LGBTQ community as well and kind of really get out there and seek out your kind of, you know, your audience. And you pretty much went to them, right? You found crossover audiences in those cabaret venues and bookshops and things.
Yes. Yeah. And you know what? It was worth it because cabaret and drag show audiences are the best audiences because they're so loud and they're so receptive and they laugh like respond because that's what you do at cabaret. And so they were the best audience members.
You've been there a couple of years now. Do you have a sense that you have a bit of a local following? Will people come and kind of, you know, take a chance on a show at Baron's Court and see, you know, whatever you are programming?
We are seeing it more and more, certainly. The first year there was a lot of, oh, I didn't know there was a theater here. I was going, ah, well, still? You know, we like to keep it secret. It's been here for 30 years, but yeah. You know, fine. But that's okay because the way it was previously, it was very offline. So I completely get there wasn't so much of a presence. Whereas now I think we're starting more and more to see folks and certainly the reviewers that come back again and again. We've had a lot of folks who want to review more and more shows, which is great. And I think like their little audiences have also helped us. And we just are slowly and surely able to guarantee a small audience. But we still say to folks, you know, you still got to talk to them. You can't just expect them to show up. So, yeah.
The conversation continues after these messages. The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This podcast is fueled by coffee. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me A Coffee link in the show notes. Welcome back to the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
I think often the biggest barrier or fear of self-producing, of course, is the funding.
100%, yeah.
Could you talk a little about the higher charges and box office arrangements with Baron's Court? Does a person need to have, you know, financial backing in place up front? Can higher charges be offset against ticket sales? Do you have a box office split? What are the arrangements with you guys?
We have a higher fee and we suggest to folks that they count on that higher fee because we've done box office splits before. And actually we had earlier this year, we had a show that sold so well that actually it wasn't to their advantage to be a box office split. So we ended up saying to them, look, this isn't actually fair to you because we've done the math. Like as long as you're breaking, you know, roughly even on a night, then it's actually better for you because I'm pretty sure we're fairly close to the cheapest in London with our ticket prices as well. We aim to keep things so that we really can hopefully as much as possible mitigate that barrier for folks.
Yeah.
So for us, once you've paid a deposit, that secures your slot and there's 20% of the higher fee. And then everything else is paid out of the ticket sales. We don't take any other money up front because we understand there needs to be some cash flow to get the thing off the ground. And then the only thing that folks are really paying for after that is someone's time as their technician and any marketing that they're doing. So like printing a poster and stuff like that. We pay for the box office staff ourselves. We do that side of it. Ticketing fees, unfortunately, are just as they are. Yeah. But other than that, we don't hold anything after the fact. We don't take a percentage of their box office.
Sure.
We just take the higher fee and that's it pretty much. Because we realize that's the amount that we need to stay open.
Yeah.
Essentially.
No, absolutely.
And so beyond that, we want people to be able to make work. We want them to leave us and have had a good experience with it and go, okay, I sold enough tickets where I can pay everyone something or my personal investment is paid back. You know, hopefully if they have funding elsewhere, then it's a whole different thing for them. They can go, yay, I've got a little bit of money for my next project. You know, that's the dream, isn't it? So yeah, our aim is definitely to make it as accessible for folks and for folks to feel afterwards that they don't have to take out a personal loan to survive because it's hard enough making work. You can't have that kind of hanging over your head the whole time.
So 20% is all somebody would need to put down in order to secure their spot.
Yeah, I think it's 190 off the top of my head. And doesn't matter what how far ahead it is, our higher fee hasn't changed in a very long time. So.
Could you talk us through your considerations beyond the script as it relates to the Baron's Court production? So what were your key expenses for a start?
Well, the theatre hire, obviously, and paying a technician. Those are things I could anticipate because I obviously signed a contract when I approached the theatre. And then there were things like rehearsal space hire can be pretty expensive, especially in London. We were pretty lucky because we had a lot of friends help us out with free rehearsal space, but that was a stress for a time. Travel expenses, because I don't live in central London, and so even getting to and from the theatre every night for a week costs like over £100. Things like props and costumes, I was like, no, I'm not spending any money. I paid maybe like £10 for fake blood, but everything else was stuff I already owned.
Right. Was there anything in the way of set, or was it essentially a suitcase show?
There was no set. There was like a bedside table and a chair on stage for the whole thing. Then I had like a glory hole made of cardboard, which was massive and really difficult to transport places, but it's fine.
I love that you now own a portable glory hole.
Oh, I didn't take it home with me. We flattened it and put it in the recycling. That was massive. Ticket barriers are really narrow, and I had to get it on the underground.
So were you able to break even in the end? What sort of house sizes were you seeing?
We never sold out any nights, but that was fine because the audiences, as I say, the audiences we did have were loud and it felt full even when it wasn't. The busiest we got was like 75% capacity, but it felt full. In terms of money, yeah, we broke even. We got a bit of profit to split with me and my co-director. A bit, but
That's
it counts.
On the fringe.
Exactly.
I think you have to always expect it'll be a loss, and if you break even, it's a bonus, and you know, profit, well, hey, it's
exactly.
That's unheard of. So well done there. Sharon, I think it's fair to say that pretty much everyone involved in Fringe Theatre is generally in it for the love of theatre and the passion of making and sharing art.
100%. I think,
you know, making a profit beyond operating costs is as scarce for venues as it is for artists. And I can imagine it's challenging just keeping the lights on most of the time, let alone being able to invest in the space and the facilities.
Yes.
I wanted to talk about the campaign you have at the moment to replace the seats at Baron's Court Theatre. How are the fundraising efforts going, and what kind of donations are you hoping to receive to make this happen?
The chairs, they're amazing, but they are just no longer, you know, fit for purpose, really. They belong in like someone's fancy lobby or something. They're from like the 1920s cinema chairs. And I really think that they make our space a little bit less accessible, especially the way the decks are set up. So our goal is to raise approximately $20,000, and that's going to go towards leveling a bit of the decking. So everything is easy. We're going to put some railings in, folks can get in and out. And what we're leaning towards really are more like bench style. So it's less individual seat and more black benches. And we think that there'll be a bit more flexibility in terms of the numbers. We might go up a tiny bit in number, we might see. But also then we can say to an artist, you know, do you really want this area for performance instead? Or, you know, I think there's a little bit more flexibility. At the moment, everything's really fixed, so you can't move anything around. And I think we start out thinking, oh, we'll do it right away. You know, it's our main thing. And 2 years later, we're like, oh, we've raised like not even a third of the money. But the folks that have given are fantastic because they really mostly are locals who know about the space or have a personal connection to the theater. And that's just been nice to connect with those people and hear why they love Baron's Court as much as we do. And so our aim is really to, however long we're running it, to leave it in a place where it feels like it's actually going to be fit for purpose for a lot longer. So we've been replacing the lights. We've been trying to talk with the pub about ideally finding a way to put a lift in that building. I think it's something that they revisit like every 10 years.
Right, for whatever reason.
You know, it just never has happened. So for me, I think looking at this space, we want to welcome as many people as possible. And, you know, we're really lucky to have won an award, you know, being the most welcoming in our first year, which was kind of insane because we don't have a foyer. You know, we don't have anywhere to linger.
Right.
We have these crazy chairs, you know. So it was a people's choice, you know. So I was like, this is very nice, but what? You know? And so for me, I wouldn't feel that we're really the most welcoming until we're welcoming for everyone. And right now, there are too many steps, and it's just, they're uneven steps. So I make us sound really dangerous. We're not, but I think it's just that thing that would mean that no matter what happens in the future, it's future-proofed so that people can feel more welcome. We can't change anything about the fact that we're downstairs. There's no lift at the moment. But at least if you walk in, then you can get in and out of the seats easier.
Yeah.
That would be a win.
Okay. So for anybody who is here listening to this and wants to support you with your chairs campaign, at least, how much buys a seat?
Yeah. £500 will get you or your loved one's name or your company's name, your charity's name, whomever will be graciously put on the back of a seat.
Okay.
I think we have like four or five of them up right now. Yes. And £500 would do that.
Okay.
And really, it's just about finding 30 or 40 people who are happy to do that.
Yeah.
You know, so it feels doable. I mean, we're grateful for all the support we get. And we get support in other ways as well. But for me, this feels like it would be a win for pub theaters if we can get these
absolutely
seats redone.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I feel like 20 years ago, when I was looking at taking shows to the Fringe, we'd always considered Baron's Court. And I remember people saying, oh, no, the seats, you know, people don't want to sit there. You know, that was 20 years ago. So it's, yeah, it's got to, I think we've got to really value our pub theatres, you know.
For sure.
Because at times when, you know, we're looking at threats to the Royal Court, getting anything in front of the National is very difficult. There are so few opportunities for playwrights. And it feels like pub theatre, fringe theatre is accessible. And it's kind of the last bastion of hope to kind of champion ourselves, back ourselves and get our work on stage.
Yeah, 100%.
Can you speak to the value of pub theatres in terms of nurturing new writing and being a platform for new writing?
Yeah, it seems like every week there's a new article about how this avenue's shut or that building's going to close. And I've personally have seen the impacts of the loss of those funds to spaces. And, you know, writers are feeling lost at sea. I think that pub theatres have for a long time been the grassroots of London theatre and wider because London theatre is such a huge platform for global theatre, you know. So I think there's no price to put on it. I think if I had my magic wand, pub theatres like ours would have a lot more financial support. I think the amount of support that we give to our artists, and we always want to do more. We always want to have more time for everyone. We want to have more opportunities to let folks have space, to have time with their stories. It's a priceless commodity. And I think it's highly undervalued at large, certainly by the theatrical media, by the way that the pub theaters are written about as though they're the kind of like this dank corner you go into, even though it might be true with us, who knows, because we're a cellar, basically. But I think the work that happens in these cellars and all, you know, above these pub theaters, they're often magical. And I think there's got to be somewhere for people to fail. There's got to be a place for someone to say, I'm going to try this crazy idea. I'm already working my behind off to like be brave in my art. And now I've got to somehow survive financially. It's dire straits for a lot of folks. And I think that was something when we took over, Leo and I were very conscientious of, and we are doing our absolute best not to raise the higher fee for that reason, even though there's pressure, because our rent went up quite a lot when we took over the lease from the prior folks that ran it. And so making it work financially for us as well doesn't really work all the time. But I know we're not alone in that. I know from, you know, the other artistic directors that I speak with that we're all cutting corners in our own pockets to make sure folks can have more time in the space or are working harder. And I think there's no real solution to it. People will say like a change in government. I think theater has always been undervalued. Now there's, you know, there's more money in TV. There's more money elsewhere. People naturally will gravitate to places where they can make a living. So I think if we want to stay a viable art form, I think you've got to respect the pub theater. You've got to value the heart that goes into all of these shows and the folks that run them, you know, not just because I'm one of them, but because I can tell 2 years in, I can't imagine doing this for like 30 years in the current financial climate, you know, the sacrifices that we make constantly to provide more space for that particular artist. You're asking a lot of a group of people who aren't given a lot to work with. And I think there's a real danger that it's going to collapse because the folks that I speak with are burnt out. They're already burnt out after the pandemic, trying to get a pub theater like ours off the ground again that had, you know, not really been looked after for a little while. Chris wouldn't mind me saying, you know, that he'd been burnt out before the pandemic and then being this small fish in this huge, you know, pond and all that. So we were already, there's been no reprieve. Like we weren't available for any support funding. We've had, you know, nothing from any public body except for a few project grants here and there. So the quality of work that we do, not just Baron's Court, but across the board is immense and it's incredibly undervalued. And I think there are very few avenues now where a writer can really try something out. where someone can say, look, I don't have all the answers, but I've got this burning thing that I've written that I need to do. And we're going to stay open as long as we can, you know, and we're going to keep giving as much as we can. But I think it's not about what we're doing, you know, it's that thing about climate change, isn't it? It's not about you recycling. It's about the corporations. And I think there's something broken in the funding system where it doesn't really trickle very far down at all.
No.
And when I've worked in spaces that are funded, I'm always like, what? Do you know, like, you have all of this resource?
Yeah.
Like, I'd be letting folks in at night. So I'm like, come on, guys, this is a resource you can share.
Yeah.
And I think if you are in an institution for a long time, it can be quite easy to forget what it's like to be outside of those kind of gilded halls, as it were. And I think for those of us that haven't really had that kind of support, I can only read those articles and go, well, I don't know what else I'm supposed to do. Do you know, Barron's Court doesn't ever get flagged as a place that's supporting people. Mm. Do you know, when the stage or whomever is writing, it's always about these bigger spaces. And it's not that I expect like a pat on the back. It's more like, before I was here, I know the Drayton Arms was doing it. I know the Broccoli Jack was doing it. I know before the Southwick Playhouse kind of grew to what it does, they were doing it. Do you know, so I know that other places are, it's kind of this invisible value that we've been giving.
Invisible, but doing a lot of the heavy lifting for those other venues because you're nurturing the talent that's going on to those venues.
100%.
That's what's forgotten, I think.
Yeah, there has to be some sort of recognition of where the stepping stones really are, where they genuinely are, and where the doors are genuinely open.
Definitely.
And sometimes it's not what you think it is. And that's okay, because venues have to make choices about where they put their resource. But I think if we're talking about genuinely leveling, you know, the landscape and opening doors and breaking down barriers, I think it's in the pub theaters 100%. Yeah. You don't have to have had like 5 shows and won an Alfie to like get into the Barron's Court. You know, you just have to have a good story and be willing to do some work.
And not just early career playwrights. We all need platforms to try new work. You know, mid-career established writers.
Yeah.
It's such a valuable breeding ground, for not just for new talent, but for new work. Looking back on your experience and overall of self-producing at Barron's Court Theatre, did you feel supported throughout the journey?
I did. I had a lot of questions for them in the lead up, and they were all very silly questions, like, when can I bring my props in? Like, how do I do this? Like, all these things. And I was mostly dealing with Leo from Barron's Court Theatre, and he was so helpful and so kind. So even though I had a bit of like social anxiety about it, I really didn't need to, especially like in the week leading up. They were really helping with marketing on social media as well. They made get-in and tech so easy. I can't stress this enough, how helpful they were on tech day. So yes, really grateful to Barron's Court Theatre for that. And look at this. They gave me a card at the end of it, and there's a watercolor painting of the theatre on the front of it.
I love that.
So it's the personal touch.
I love that. That's brilliant. So what did you enjoy most about performing your play?
I love this question. I liked it when people laughed at my jokes. I know it's a really simple answer, but it feels really good. There's bits of the show where it gets a bit more serious and everyone goes quiet, and I can feel that the attention has like shrunk in the room right onto me, and I'm like, I'm doing it. I'm holding their attention. They're listening to me. Very satisfying. I like the fun bits. Like, so with the glory hole, I had a sock puppet to play the person on the other side of the glory hole.
Brilliant.
And that was really silly and really fun. The bits with the fake blood, great. Disgusting and different every night. Never knew how much fake blood was going to come out of the sponge, so that was always exciting. Yep. I loved the bits with the music. Sounded so good on the system. My friend Ruby Wednesday, who is a drag performer and musician, very kindly let us use music from their album, and it was such a good addition to the show that I could have predicted while I was writing. It's something that kind of happened in rehearsals. I could go on and on, honestly.
Sharon, a successful run on the fringe in a pub theatre can look different for every writer and every artist depending on their own measure of success. So more generally speaking, in broader terms, I guess, what do you think fringe success looks like?
You know, I'll be very philosophical. I think a successful one is one where you finish the run and you know, you recognize you might need some rest, but you still want to stay in theatre.
Yeah.
You still want to make the next show. I think where you feel like, this is what worked, this didn't work, but I still want to figure out what that is.
Right.
I still want to seek that thing out and answer that question, whatever it is that didn't work for them. whether it was production wise or was with the story. In terms of reaching your audience, if you feel like they came and saw it, that's always a great feeling. And that's important because that's a mirror for you to judge your work. You know, it's great if you get a bunch of reviews that say 4 or 5 stars, but reviews can be so subjective. Yeah. And they often, so it's really about, you know, what did that critic pick up on? Is that something I want to, that I, you know, want to work on? And it was it useful feedback versus the star system?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think, I know it sounds really, I guess, like old, but that sense of if you finish it and you feel like, yeah, I still want to carry on with this thing, I'm more excited to make work now because I've had that joy of doing it.
Yeah.
I realize I need to take a holiday first and I'm poor, but I'm going to get back to it and write the next thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe it's about being intentional with your goals at the beginning then. What do I want to get out of this run? Whether that's to get good production photography, a set of reviews, you know, audience feedback, see it on its feet, try it with different actors, you know, see it in different spaces.
100%. That's why we spend so much time really asking those questions with artists. I think it's one of the first things, like we say, come and have a tour, because sometimes folks haven't actually been to Barron's Court. And it's like, let's have a look at it first, you know, if this is the right. See a show with us. And then we chat with them. We're like, you know, why do you want to do this? Why is this the story for now? Mm. And often we'll get, you know, a bit about their lives, we'll get a bit about, you know, their history as an artist. And it'll be less about even what the thing is, but it's why do they want to make it? And how can we make sure that they reach that goal? And that is success, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And what about in recent times? Are there any specific projects or productions you can speak to, or perhaps things in the pipeline coming up that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, I think for me, like I mentioned earlier about Deaf as a Post, it's coming up. That started off as a Sunday Fix show. So the Sunday Fix is our scratch night. You submit 10 minutes and then we do maybe 3 or 4 script and hand readings. And we have a Q&A guest, usually someone that's a bit further along, or maybe that programs for a space, that kind of thing. They do a bit of chat and then we do a bit of feedback. And Sean submitted his work and it was the first thing he'd written, as far as I know. And that's now going to be as a fully fledged production with us next month. That's success for me. Do you know, that's how I look at it. And in terms of, I guess, like success for the artists that have come through, I mean, we've had award nominations. We've had, you know, folks that have gotten agents out of it, that have gotten to have their plays published. That feels like a success for the writer because it's always nice. I think looking ahead for us, a success is knowing that we have roughly the year kind of sketched out, even though it's not kind of cemented, the idea that we're a place that people seem to want to come back to. We have several people that have come back to us. We have a show that's penciled for this summer that's with the same company that came last summer from the US, and they want to bring another work in translation, you know, so for me, that's success. You know, I'm working on a show right now, Three Queens, which is another debut playwright. She's written quite a lot, but she's never actually been able to get something on. And for me, you know, regardless what happens, that's a success.
Yeah,
and we've had folks like that have had readings, do like off West End readings or West End readings. And we've had folks we've worked with who are now on like different writers groups, like the BBC Writers Room. So folks do travel, you know, but we like to think of the places they can come back to try out something else.
Yeah.
And that's when we've had companies, one of them has been with us 3 times now. And that just feels like, you know, we're building a community. And every person that feels like they've been, you know, they've had agency over their story, they've been valued by us here, we've been a collaborator too, then that's a success for us. So hopefully lots of successes.
Absolutely.
It's good to think about it.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
So, Christopher, what would you say to anyone who is perhaps on the fence but considering bringing new writing to the stage off their own back and under their own steam without barriers?
I feel like anyone who's on the fence has probably truly already know whether they're going to do it or not, because either they need to do it and they're going to do it no matter what, or they don't care enough and then it's not going to happen. You do have to really care because it is really hard. And I could have given up many, many, many times. I can't tell you how many times I thought about it, but it was never really an option to stop. And even with when things started to fall apart, it was always, I was always making whatever choices would get the show done. So my advice is follow your heart and know that it is a financial risk. That is the other thing. If I could go back in time and warn myself how much money it was going to cost, like travel and all this stuff creeps up on you, especially because I wasn't working another job at the same time. So I guess there's that. I think I've learned a lot about what I'm capable of and what I'm capable of bouncing back from. Yeah.
For sure. For sure, I would say the personal development, practical experience, and pure enjoyment alone that it sounds like the room provided. It's been an absolutely worthwhile endeavor and a brilliant investment in yourself and your art as well. So well done for putting the show and yourself out there, Christopher. Really, well done for making it happen. And thanks for being here and sharing your story with us too. Really appreciate it.
Okay, no worries.
Thanks, Christopher. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We touched briefly on Sunday Fix, which just sounds like a really great entry point in terms of getting to establish a relationship with you at Barron's Court. Could you just give us an overview of kind of when that is, how often it is, and the steps to get involved in that?
Yeah, sure thing. It's a monthly event. We don't do one in August because of Edinburgh and often over in December, but it's a rolling submission. So anytime a writer feels like, I really want to have this read out loud, I'm at a point now where I don't want to hear it in my head anymore, someone else needs to say it, then they can submit 10 minutes of it. And I often say to folks, because if we get inquiries, I'll say, look, don't send me the whole script. If it's 45 pages, send me the bit that you're really struggling with. Send me the bit that you're like, I really need feedback on. Because what we'll do is you have an hour with a director and a team of smart actors who will work on your script. And then after it's presented, I do a bit of gentle kind of guided feedback, because I like to think of it as the first audience. We help writers kind of understand what's working. We help them go, okay, well, I think my play is this. And often some of the responses are, oh, that's not a play, you know? So I think it's helpful for that. So it's less about presenting, I guess, a finished idea.
Yeah.
We don't do any props, no stage directions. It's literally just the words and what the audience kind of interprets with some basic staging and some blocks. There's no tech or anything. So it's really about the writer kind of getting the most out of it. And so my hope is that when they sit back down, they have some ideas about where they want to go next with the whole piece. And we've had some of those pieces have gone on to be full things. We had a show that went over to the King's Head that started out as a Sunday Fix thing. Now we're doing one of our own, which is really lovely. And we had some folks come through a few times, you know. It's about being that space that's held for them once a month. And we take on as many scripts as we can. You know, we can't always see everyone's, but we always let people know.
Yeah.
And same with the Q&A guests. We really want to bring someone in who is going to be open to taking their email in the future, or will, you know, hopefully kind of remember them if they see them at another event.
Sure.
For me, it was about holding a space that was about sharing knowledge.
Yes.
So it's really about opening up access.
Okay. Fantastic. And I guess a really easy way of getting involved in that or seeing that on its feet is to come along and watch one of your Sunday Fix sessions. So how do people get tickets for that?
Well, it's a free event. We try and keep it free, as many things for free as possible at Barron's Court.
Well, I assume donations to the new seats are welcome.
Well, yes. You can donate so that the seat that you're sat on will be replaced with a much more comfortable seat. And if you go to our website, you can reserve your seat there, and you can make a donation when you reserve your seat. But if you're not able to, everyone's welcome regardless. So there's no fee to, as a writer, to submit. There's no fee for anyone involved. It's just really about building community and letting everyone in the door, basically.
Yeah. I love it. It's a much needed platform you're providing for writers, Sharon. So thank you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me, Sharon.
Yeah, it's been great to chat with you and to consider these things in a fresh light.
Yeah, for sure. I look forward to catching a show at Barron's Court soon.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast.
Thanks for joining me again, and a huge thanks, of course, to Sharon and Christopher for sharing their thoughts and their time with us. If you'd like to learn more about Barron's Court Theatre or connect with Christopher, you'll find all of the links in the show notes, as well as the link for tickets to Bunnyman at Bite Size Festival in July if you're in London and would like to see Christopher's show.
Next time.
Join me as I bring my conversations with Winter Miller and Madeline George, celebrated playwrights in their own names and members of the trailblazing New York playwrights collective 13P.
The invitation was, do the play that you don't think anyone else is going to produce. What a great invitation. Most theater companies aren't going to, you know, offer you that.
People had to have the right mix of like irritation and ambition and willingness to sort of throw their lot in with other people as a way of breaking through what felt like, you know, just an insuperable barrier to full production at that time.
We discuss the innovative spirit of 13P, their experience of staging their plays as part of the collective, and how together their 13-strong number championed their plays to the stage. As always, your support and feedback are greatly appreciated. I'd love it if you'd subscribe to the podcast and consider leaving a review if you enjoyed the episode. Remember, every great production starts with a single idea. So until next time, keep writing and stay inspired.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Writer's Toolkit podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to leave a review and share the link with your friends. This podcast is fueled by coffee. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes.